We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the Youth League football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Welcome to the Solid Verbal.
The Solid Verbal.
Come after me! I'm a man! I'm 40!
I've heard so many players say, well, I want to be happy. You want to be happy for a day? Eat a steak.
It's that woo woo!
And now, Dan and Ty.
Welcome back to the Solid Verbal, boys and girls. My name is Ty Hildenbrandt, that fine gentleman over there. As always, the one, the only, still the incomparable swim dad of the year, Dan Rubenstein. Sir! How you doing today?
I'm sick of having to be the one who answers that question and the pressure of saying something interesting or funny or witty or pithy. You just keep going, Ty. You're putting the personality pressure on me. You're getting a haircut today. We're talking college football top threes, be it on the field or off, but everything related directly or indirectly to college football. I'm in a good mood. I almost had heat stroke last night on a 95 degree plus tennis court.
Yeah.
Because I'm not in the shape I think I'm in. My lungs aren't where they should be. So all in all, Ty, it's another great day to be here with you.
On today's show, it is preseason polls, but of a different variety, Daniel.
Yes.
It is the summer of the Verballer, at least the June of the Verballer. So here's what we did. We spent the better part of yesterday, you did specifically, posting stuff out to social media.
Mm-hmm.
Prompting the Verballerhood for their top threes.
Yes.
We're not talking like Remington watch list top threes, Heisman watch list type three. We're talking things of the ilk like, who are your top three coaches not named Nick Saban? Or what are your top three college towns? Who are your top three favorite college football announcers, mascots you'd want to chill with, so on and so forth. Doing our best here in mid-June to cover all the nooks and crannies of the college football ether. We wanted your feedback. We got it. We want your feedback after this show as well in response to what we're going to go through today. But we've collected all of those results. If you want us to do more of this, we're enjoying it. If you out there listening want us to do more of this, please do not hesitate to hit the follow or subscribe button on your podcasting app of choice. That helps. If you've
Big impact.
Yeah, huge impact. If you've already taken that very important first step to joining the Verballerhood, perhaps tell a friend. Because we are enjoying reconnecting with the Verballerhood at large, college football fans near and far, finding out what makes them, what makes you tick throughout the college football offseason as we build into previews next month.
Go to your parents' homes, go to your relatives' homes, go to your children's homes, surreptitiously open up their laptops and their phones and just boop, subscribe.
Is that
boop,
a felony? Subscribe. We don't want to promote felonious activity.
I think they're no, it's not. It can't be. It can't be. I took 3 days of journalism ethics before dropping the class, and they didn't mention anything about that. So we're good.
We're in the clear. All right.
Yeah.
This show, all of our shows, brought to you by, driven by our good friends over at Geico. Don't forget, verballers.com is our super secret, and actually not that secret, Patreon community, where you can go for early access to all of our episodes, get bonus content, get access to the Discord, where you can interact with Dan and I. We hop on to Discord pretty frequently. You can play games starting up pretty soon. A lot to look forward to over at verballers.com. SolidGiveaway.com is the ongoing sweepstakes slash contest that we've got going on. This month, you can throw your name in the hat to win a Brian Brzee plays for Clemson, signed Clemson mini helmet. And last but certainly not least, before I run out of breath here, Dan, follow us all across social media. We've been doing a lot out on YouTube, posting clips from each episode. We're also posting a lot to Twitter, to Instagram, to Facebook. And oh, by the way, we've got a TikTok. Not dancing yet, but it's still pretty early.
Yeah, that's true. Oh God, how many Patreon subscribers do we need to get to for you to recreate the girl crying while doing a trendy dance? You've seen that video? Have you seen that before? Where she's like very sad, maybe about being broken up with, or, you know, she's mourning something, but she's still dedicated to the trendy dance cause as she's dancing.
It doesn't need to be happy, that sad. High of a number. It's not as bad as my personally disastrous Mother's Day, which I will only tell the story about if we get to 5,000.
I'll go as far as saying physically, emotionally, mentally disastrous.
Personally disastrous in every facet of the word. Every facet of your imagination. We get to 5,000 Patreon subs, and I'll tell that story, but not before
I would say it was the worst possible outcome of going on the show Double Dare and it going horrifically within your personal life.
Moving on. Okay.
Yeah. What are we doing?
Today's episode, Dan, what are we doing? We talked about it at the top. We put out the call for Verballer feedback. We've got a bunch of Verballer feedback here. You've got a sound, don't you?
I do, because we received a lot of answers and I wanted to make sure we're all buttoned up. I haven't heard a printer sound like that in a long time. I think that is an inkjet printer. I have not owned an inkjet printer in some time. I'm ready. We asked for top threes. Do you have a place that we're going to start? I have my own answers for these top threes. You have some of your own answers for top threes. I just wanted to, it's sort of a survey, right? It's a poll survey shot across the bow at the Verballers, how they're feeling about overrated, underrated teams, certain coaches, towns, food, mascots. Just, I want to know where we stand. You know, it's just a check-in with everybody. We did this on Twitter, correct?
We did it just on Twitter, and we got an insane amount of response. So what we did as a group here is we went through, we pulled some of our favorites, and what we're going to try and do after the fact is tag everybody that we mention.
Yeah.
Everybody who took the time to give us some of their thoughts here. We couldn't gather them all because it would have taken all day. But as best we can, I'm going to try to tag folks out on Twitter so they know that we appreciate them reaching out, being part of the show. Let's start with a very controversial question.
I'm ready.
We put out the call for top three worst college football towns.
Okay.
Now, if you boil off some of the snarky comments that we got, not just with this question, but with all of them, a healthy amount of snark still in the Verballerhood, which is a good thing. Keeping our wits about us, which I like.
Yeah.
Top three worst college towns. You have been to more college towns than I have.
Yeah.
I am not qualified to answer this. I'm not even going to try. Yeah. Where do you stand on this?
Anywhere really cold. That's my answer. As somebody, and you did this as well, as somebody who attended a place that gets pretty cold and dark and gray and damp for a wide swath of the school year, oh man, is it incredible. Showing up to school in September and then getting back out to the quad when it's nice out in May, late April, May. You had that same situation at State College where, look, it's not tropical in State College in February, in November. It's not a destination weather-wise. So I put those as the worst, because if I had to do it all over again, loved my experience at Oregon, if I had to do it all over again, I would probably attend a warmer place. because when you are between 18, 21, and 22, you're going through all sorts of social changes, Ty. It's good to see other humans not bundled up.
So
how about
here,
that?
I agree.
Yeah.
Having lived that experience, I get where you're coming from. The way we worded the question was top three worst college football towns.
Okay.
College
top three worst college football towns.
And I think there is a difference there. So
I hear you.
Case in point, we've got the weather argument, which could be made for sure for some.
Yep.
I would argue State College is a great college football town in terms of college weather. Maybe not as good as Athens, Georgia, but different question.
Maybe
altogether.
Not as good.
Maybe not
well,
as
look,
good.
I've been to a Georgia game in late August, and that has its own difficulties. It has its own difficulties because it's hot as balls in Georgia in late August, early September. So I hear you. Continue.
The other question that came up,
yeah,
which I thought was very interesting, is Austin a college football town?
It is. Of course it is. Like so like you can say like LA with USC and UCLA in its own way, like the very specific area around the USC campus and the UCLA campus, right? Those are college football towns in some way, even though I guess the college football stadium is not in Westwood. It's in Pasadena. But you can talk about those as college towns that people are excited in some way about football. Less so for New York and, you know, smaller schools. Shout out Fordham, of course. Like it's different. But there are there is an area around, like if you go to Dirty Sixth in Austin, it's going to be a bunch of college kids doing college things and watching college football games at bars and saloons and the like. So, yes, I am considering if you don't like Austin, that's a good answer for this.
Yeah. And we got a couple Austin answers here, which is why I bring it up. We had some folks on Twitter asking, is Austin even a college football town? It is a college football town, maybe not in the same way.
Yeah.
As State College. But in its own right, it is. So I want to get your answers, but I do want to call out some of the ones that we had come in. The Group of Five Focus Pod polled its people, and Ruston, Louisiana came up time and again. That's Louisiana Tech. That's where they're at. I've never been to Ruston, Louisiana.
Got some Waco answers, possibly from TCU fans.
From TCU fans. John Hollinger, you know him from The Athletic. He says New York, Boston, and Providence.
Yeah.
Okay. Rick Sanchez from The Athletic says Cheney, Washington, which is where Eastern Washington is.
Eastern, yeah.
Pocatello, Idaho, which is Idaho State, and San Jose. I have never been to any of those places. Have you?
Been to San Jose. Have not been to Cheney or Pocatello. What makes for a bad college football town? So even if you haven't been to many, and I've been to a bunch of college football towns, I don't know how many I'd consider to be bad, but to you, see, I'll give you my answer.
Yeah.
Bad hotel options. I'm not talking about nice hotel options. I'm talking about non-existent hotel options or having to stay an hour and a half away.
Sure.
Like if your school has grown to the point where it is a destination for college football, I would hope the town would be growing with it in some sort of meaningful way over the years and having lodging options, interesting food options, things to do, whether that's a running trail, whether that's hiking, whether that's a brewery, whether that's a golf course, something like that, where you're just like, okay, I'm coming into town for a couple of nights with some buddies. What is there to do besides going to the game and tailgating and, you know, going to a campus area bar? So that makes for a good college football town where it's just like a destination for road fans. We are like, yeah, I definitely want to go to Knoxville or Columbia, Missouri or Tempe, Arizona. Like to have those options in terms of conveniences and activities, I think are what makes for a good college football town. Now, the bigger city you get to, the more complicated that is because of, you know, if you're going to LA for a USC game, you could be staying an hour away still within Los Angeles. You're going to be fighting traffic. So LA has its own, there's all sorts of things that are, as somebody from there, unattractive about living and going to LA. So you want that healthy medium. And so like, I've really enjoyed going to Ann Arbor. I think Ann Arbor is a really cool place to do things and go to a college football game.
What other answers do you have? Anything else?
For bad towns?
Yeah.
I didn't love Clemson, and it was more of, it's difficult to get to. There wasn't much to do in Clemson itself. I didn't love South Bend. I love the experience of going to the Notre Dame campus, but like the town of South Bend, and I don't know, I may have missed things. It was a long time ago, so maybe I just don't remember. that was just a forgettable like town slash city experience for me. Northern Indiana didn't really do it for me.
Didn't move the needle for Dan Rubenstein.
No.
Some of the other ones that we got here, we got from Kelso 02, LA, Miami, and Austin. There's Austin again. What about Miami? Miami kind of falls into that category of bigger
Coral
city.
Gables, yeah.
Makes it complicated. The other thing that I think would bubble to the surface for me if I were answering this question is, what is the college football culture in a particular place? If there's a night game, there's an 8 p.m. night game, what is the tailgating scene like before the game?
True.
What is that like? It's going to be different depending on where you go.
Right.
The 8 p.m. night game at Virginia is going to be very, very different than what I'm used to in state college. Doesn't mean it's better or worse, but you're just going to have those disparities across many different college towns. I care about that culture and what the atmosphere feels like outside the stadium. To that end, I'm not sure if Miami so much rises to
the
crop here.
Okay. I went to a Miami game a long time ago, and so I can't speak to the current stadium. I've heard traffic isn't great. It's an NFL stadium. It's not in Miami proper. And so like even in these big cities, like if you go to a USC game, if you go to a Texas game in these bigger cities, that the area around the stadium, right? There's an energy to it. And like, you know, there's traffic everywhere going to a college football stadium. Of course, like the infrastructure basically everywhere cannot handle a ton of cars going to a stadium. But yeah, when you think about Miami, you're going to get the lodging, you're going to get the food, you're going to get the activities. The stadium's a little farther away, and it doesn't seem like you're getting the Miami loves the Canes kind of thing in the same way.
It's not like Philly loves the Eagles, right?
Lubbock loves the Red Raiders. Like that kind of you're not getting that. It's a big city and it's hard to achieve that. But even in Texas, in downtown Austin, there is an energy about Texas games. It's not a great in-stadium experience, but the culture around with the burnt orange and the barbecue is still significant to me.
I think that's how I would view this question, the lens through which I would answer. Again, top three worst college football towns. To read a few other ones off, then we've got a number of other things to get through. CCM Jr. says Starkville, Greenville, and Gainesville. Going with the Vills.
Gainesville was okay. It was totally good by me.
Tyler Dunn says Minneapolis. We've been to Minneapolis, a fine town.
Yeah.
Don't know what it's like on game day. Could
freaking
be cold.
Cold, man.
Dan, not you, a different one, says State College, which I would vehemently disagree with.
So, okay. You've been to some Big Ten towns. You've been to Ann Arbor. You haven't been to Columbus, I don't think. What other Big Ten towns have you been to? I don't even know.
Ann Arbor.
Have you been to Madison?
No.
Have you been to Piscataway?
No.
Beautiful Piscataway, New Jersey? No. You've been to College Park?
No.
Okay, so you haven't been to many Big Ten
towns. Stop asking the question. You know the
answer. So as somebody who has been to college towns, State College would be very, very low on my list. Nothing to do with State College. Very difficult to get to, and not a fun experience getting to there. So for that reason,
I get that.
State College is down. I don't know the lodging situation, but it's pretty. Like I would much rather recommend to somebody, because we get these people asking, you know, where should I? Me and my buddies go to one game a year. I don't know, Ann Arbor, or Madison, probably in the Big Ten are your answers.
Didn't you also fly into Pittsburgh?
Yeah, but if you're coming from elsewhere, Tyler, you can't just
amateur
fly
hour.
Into Harrisburg.
Amateur hour. We'll talk about
from
this
the
later.
West Coast.
We'll talk about this later.
I needed a reasonable fare too.
Whatever. Hamilton says Lubbock, 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 and Kyle's says Toledo, Toledo, Toledo. So, all right, I've driven through Toledo.
It's fine. I have, as have I.
Next topic, Dan. Play that sound one more time. Can I play that again?
What do we got? Our inkjet printer. We're printing something out from our compact.
We have the results for the top three most overrated teams. Ooh.
Oh, I like this. Okay.
Ooh.
So this is more of a perception thing because we're in the off season. So the teams that are generating a healthy amount of positive buzz summer before the season.
There is a recurring theme. I would say of the seven or eight answers that I pulled.
Mm-hmm.
All but one mentioned USC. That includes the Spirit of Coryat, Brett, Miles, Dan, Connor, Mike.
Yeah.
All of these folks mentioned USC in their list. Is USC overrated, Dan?
Probably. The thing that makes them more properly rated is, I think, people looking at the medium or long-term potential of having a coach and probably a long list of quarterbacks as good as Lincoln Riley, and his future quarterbacks will be obviously Caleb Williams now, and I think it's Malachi Nelson is the quarterback of the future at the moment, but he will keep, and understandably so, attracting the best of the best quarterback-wise. The problem with USC is it's not a place in the modern era through multiple coaches, and like you can look at the reasons why certain coaches were hired or not hired, that has succeeded. 80s, 90s, there is a specific Hall of Fame caliber coach who succeeded at USC in Pete Carroll at a very specific time, whereas I just, in a number of ways, I think times are different in terms of commitment at USC. I know it's improved, but a lot of the times, like our friend Bill Connolly likes to say, it's not the coach, it's not the players, it's the place.
It's the
and
place.
Is it the kind of place that can continually foster a 10-plus, 9-plus, 11-plus win program? And we keep going back to the USC well, that there's so much hope among sports writers. Please, just USC, it's time. It's time, please. And for there's always a reason. There's always something. Oh, well, we couldn't do it because of this. Oh, well, this happened. Oh, well, this circumstance. You got to see it before you rate them properly. You got to see something. And so there's understandably more hope now, but right now there's just there's a little too much in the way of college football talkers saying, it's all happening. It's all finally happening.
And you know what? I think I get it. I think I get it to some extent, because Lincoln Riley leaving Oklahoma to go to USC was the story of the offseason.
Right.
It's the story of the offseason, and it kind of happened before the season was over, right?
Sure.
It was a story that everybody is still talking about. There's still some bad blood. There will be for a while at Oklahoma. The whole USC with transfer portals and NIL and getting big names to come.
Sure.
Look, it's going to be a story. And I think as a result, I get it. If maybe more so this year than any other year we've seen in recent memory, I get it if you want to overrate USC. I think they'll be better. They will certainly be interesting. And so I get where they're coming from on that front. I don't disagree with the take here. Another one that pops up is Texas.
Yeah.
Texas is interesting. Overrated.
I mean, you can just sort of take everything I said about USC and apply it to Texas. Yeah.
Right. Is there more of an inkling, more of a desire, let's say, among national college football media to make USC a thing or to make Texas a thing?
Interesting. I think it has to do with some of the bigger writers that live on the West Coast and are more familiar with USC. I think there is a desire for Texas. I think there is more of a desire for Texas because it's in a state that is more football crazy, and they are looked at. I think they have the biggest athletic department, or they're generating the most athletic revenue. There's something there with Texas. They have their own network. Like, Texas churns out a lot of alumni. Like, I think there's just more juice around Texas. USC is a smaller private school. Not tiny, but it's still a smaller private school. And it's in a town where it's like in fifth place or something in terms of the level of excitement over that team. So I think USC is more conceptual. Like, it would be cool if USC were again as good as it was with Pete Carroll. But Texas, like, people are mystified. People are hopeful with USC. People are mystified as to why Texas can't get it together with proximity to talent and the success they had during a brief window in the 2000s.
Sure.
Like, there is the idea that Texas should be closer to becoming dynastic than USC.
Dynastic. Yes, exactly. Okay. Some others that were submitted here. Just going to rifle through these. Pitt, San Diego State, Rutgers. How's Rutgers overrated?
That was by win total, I think. But yeah.
Okay. We've got Miami. We've got Oklahoma State, West Virginia. Oklahoma is mentioned here. Michigan State. Okay. Texas A&M's an interesting one. A&M's an interesting one.
Are they getting, besides for you, are they getting like dark horsey 10-win buzz? Or is it more centered around the personality of Jimbo Fisher, the dust up? Oh man, the word of the week. The dust up with Nick Saban, the recruiting class, and another a situation where people are sort of sleeping giant, Texas A&M, where they've never proven anything. At least with Texas and USC, they had their little windows where Texas A&M had, you know, Johnny Football for a year and a half. That's the difference to me. So I think there's certainly hope, and you can talk yourself into Texas A&M ascending to a certain point, but I don't know if there's a lot of overrating A&M, maybe over hyping or over buzzing, but I don't think people are looking right now at Texas A&M as like a clear threat in the West.
There's a lot of marketing. We're getting a lot of banner ads for Texas A&M.
It's the off season, of course.
At the moment, right? There are a lot of Instagram ads as you're scrolling through your feed. Talking about Texas A&M, reminding you that Texas A&M had a historic recruiting class, reminding you of the so-called dust up with Nick Saban and Jimbo Fisher. There's definitely buzz. And I think expectations are going to continue to rise just as a result of the recruiting class. And with Jimbo being there, Jimbo's won a national championship. He's a good coach. I think you're going to continue to see that pressure ratchet up.
By the way, I have a couple more. My just cold water overrated teams.
Please. What else do you have?
I don't know if it's internally overrated, but I'm definitely throwing some cold water on Oklahoma and Michigan.
Mm.
Michigan is a prime candidate for, as talented as they've been on offense, at least around the quarterback position, recruited really well on defense. The combination of two new coordinators, a coach who'd rather be elsewhere, or at one point would very clearly tried to be elsewhere and now supposedly has made peace with the fact that he is the Michigan man. And having the kind of game wrecker that Aiden Hutchinson was, that isn't very clearly at least on their roster right now, and what that did in terms of how offenses had to play. Part of me thinks the 2021 Michigan team was lightning in a bottle. And there is a regression coming, a regression even with the offensive talent that they have. That to me is worrisome. Oklahoma, it's just, it's unfair to hoist the expectations on Brent Venables because of the coaching drama. Like, I definitely think Oklahoma's in for a year one adjustment.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Oklahoma was the first team I thought of. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. A lot of Oklahoma people who listen to this. I'm excited about Oklahoma. I'm going to root for Brent Venables like crazy. It's just
Why?
What? Why?
Why? Well, I don't know. You're going to root for him like crazy?
Yeah. It's a great story. Going back home, taking over for Lincoln Riley.
Okay.
Trying to build the ship in a different way to spite Lincoln Riley. That's what college football is all about.
I know. I hear you.
So yeah, I'm going to root for him. I want to see him do well. I just don't know how well he can do in year one.
I think they're going to have really fun moments on both sides of the ball. I'm just not sure that they're there in terms of, like, keep the train going, playoff expectation. Like, that's a lot for year one. Next,
top three most underrated teams. Here are some of the responses we got. I think this is a much more interesting question, frankly.
Let's do it.
I don't like to look at the overrated. Let's talk about the teams that need a little bit more love. The 1012 Network on Twitter says Kansas State, Houston, and Arkansas. Nate, who is a hockey coach up in Minnesota.
Hey,
we've got Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin as his three. Brett says Maryland, Arkansas, BYU, another Arkansas to add to that list. Miles says Baylor, Wisconsin, San Diego State. Dan, another Minnesota. Says Virginia Tech, Minnesota, Wazoo. Connor says Baylor, Oklahoma State, Pitt. Mike says Clemson. Clemson, interesting. Iowa State. And
no,
Washington.
Clemson's an interesting answer, but continue.
And Carl, it should be said, gave the same answer for both over and underrated in saying Michigan, Texas, and Notre Dame, which is actually not a horrible way to approach this question.
No, that's fine. It's kind of a cop out, but it's good.
Explain Clemson to me. Why do you think that's an interesting answer from Mike?
I just think they're below the radar right now. Now, I understand the criticism surrounding Dabo and the transfer portal and potentially missing on DJU just to, you know, to keep the five-star thing going where, you know, it at the moment seems like a misevaluation, we'll see, by everybody involved. that I just think coming off of last year that they were quietly, they were excellent on defense, but they quietly improved within the ACC. I think they exclusively lost to good to really good teams. There were close calls against not so good teams. I hear you. But right now is the time in which Dabo can most effectively say, like, you know, the Roy bus and everything like that, that like they can say, no, yeah, everybody's just talking about, you know, Alabama returning a Heisman quarterback and Ohio State, you know, with the new hires and peaking and all these crazy receivers year in and year out. Whereas Clemson, I think there's reason why people are sleeping on the Tigers, especially on offense. But and the loss of the coaches that they lost, of course. But that sort of qualifies as underrating them because of, I still think they have an interesting ceiling.
Sure.
But they are finding themselves on the outer orbit of those elite team conversations because of last year.
It's tough to list a team like Clemson that's got an over-under of 10.5 wins in the underrated category.
Oh, I agree that there are expectations that they bounce back. I'm talking about underrated in terms of like, it just seems to have been a very quiet offseason so far.
Yeah, narrative.
In terms of people talking Clemson football.
Yeah. By the way, I was prepared on the episode we did on Tuesday to say that we were doing like a little bit of a game, you and I, just internally on our Slack chat about who is this year's Michigan or who is this year's Alabama. I think you can make a pretty good case this year's Georgia could be Clemson. Maybe we'll get into that at some point. I like Clemson a lot. A lot does depend on that quarterback spot, though. They're going to have a defense that's very solid. Mm-hmm. They're going to be healthier, you would presume, on offense. You would hope on offense. The quarterback thing, I think, is going to be pretty big, as will the coaching staff.
See, I just don't think they have the guys on offense. Like, I think their recruiting has, or their evaluation or development or something, like the killer receivers don't seem to be there. The offensive line seems to be like pretty average. We'll see if it improves this year. I don't know what the Georgia comp is, but.
Well, we'll get into that on another show, but I want to keep going through these because it got some good answers. For me, the two.
Underrated.
The two that I'll throw out here, Minnesota was mentioned a couple times. Minnesota's over under a 7.5. I made the bet on the Tuesday podcast. I quite literally logged the bet for over Minnesota 7.5 on the last podcast because a lot coming back, veteran leadership, schedule works very much to their favor. I think Minnesota's a good answer for underrated. I'd also throw Texas Tech in for reasons that we described in our schedule preview show weeks ago. Texas Tech's interesting to me, if only because they find themselves playing pretty much everyone on their schedule at a really interesting point.
Yep.
They're like...
For the opponents,
They're the ever-present Forrest Gump team where they just find their way into weird situations and they're going to dump a couple teams. I don't know who yet, but it will happen. And I think because of that, it'll help Joey McGuire build a little bit of momentum in Lubbock.
Here's my question. What do you think about... I have Baylor as underrated because they full on won the Big 12 last year.
Great answer.
In Dave Aranda's tenure. And outside of Bohannon transferring and Chapin being named the guy, and I don't know how many assistants, I know they lost one assistant on defense at least, but I don't know, year two of Grimes calling the plays on offense. Like Dave Aranda's defense is pretty multiple and complicated and just getting more experience with that. Like, I don't know. I think they're sneaky dangerous again. And I have not jumped into what they do and don't return overall as a roster, but I don't know. The Baylor conversation has not been all that loud. I have NC State as underrated, but inching towards properly rated.
Mm.
Like, I think people are accepting of NC State as a legit good team right now. And so it's hard at NC State to be a team that's always talked about all offseason long, but still I think they have a good amount of potential with defense and quarterback returning. I've got another team for you. Is LSU underrated right now?
LSU,
here's what LSU is. They're a team with talent at most places, if not all places. Raw, undeveloped, potentially. Quarterback questions, for sure. New head coach and staff, obviously. But what they did was replace a head coach with incredible highs and dumbfounding lows with, I know you're going to, there's too much baggage. There's too much background with you and this coach and Brian Kelly. Brian Kelly might be one of the three or four best coaches in the sport.
Correct.
And if nothing else, what Brian Kelly does, save for a 4-8 year, you remember that, is win a ton of games without high-level quarterback play.
Yes, he's very good at that.
And what LSU has had since Nick Saban and Les Miles and Ed Orgeron has been volatility. Mm. Brian Kelly brings a certain amount of been there, done that. I turn non-NFL quarterbacks into winning college football quarterbacks. And maybe LSU has 1, 2, 3 NFL quarterbacks on the roster. I don't know. But right now, there's just a quarterback question, and that never phases Brian Kelly as he continues to win games with quarterback questions. And LSU is now locking into a full-on, very strong coach.
Here is why I like LSU as an answer here in the underrated category. For those of us who are familiar with the work of one BK Brian Kelly, in his time at Notre Dame, especially when he first got there, not to say this wasn't the case throughout his tenure, but when he coached his first season in South Bend in 2010, that was a young team, that was a scrappy team, and he was very much rebuilding after the proverbial flood.
Right.
That was a team that went 8-5. They played hard in every single game. They won the Sun Bowl, whatever it was, and that team was so scrappy. And I think for those of us that followed Notre Dame football and are Notre Dame fans, we came away from that season feeling pretty good about what the next season had in store, feeling like things were about to take a leap. Now, it didn't quite take a leap per se. All right. They went 8-5 the following year as well, I think.
Yeah.
But the point here is just that at LSU, where there is more talent on hand in year one for Brian Kelly, I think you can immediately expect to see some sort of impact like that, where just the team is playing harder and the team is feistier and the team is in more games and has a chance to win more games than under the previous regime. There were moments under Coach O and Ed Orgeron where you're wondering, like, what's the situation at LSU?
Yeah.
Are these guys playing to their full potential right now? I think BK will get the most out of that roster as humanly possible. And I expect they're going to be a much tougher out. Even if they're not winning 9 games, they're going to be a tough out.
I am bullish on Brian Kelly, who did not bat 1,000 doing so, but hiring coordinators. After the string of defensive coordinators in Elko Lee and Marcus Freeman, offensive coordinators been sort of hit and miss. Chip Long was good for the program, kind of hit his limit, but they were an efficient offense with Chip Long. And look, he hired BVG. There were bad moments. But I think in the wake of who Ed Orgeron hired post Joe Brady and Dave Aranda, that has to be looked at as a positive, and to me, thus underrating LSU in the short and near term.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Let's go on. Or play the sound one more time, just so I can reset here.
Please, of course.
The results are in for the three best college football TV announcers. Okay.
Okay.
So, a couple ways that we need to approach this. We got a variety of different answers because there are different classifications, if you will.
Yep.
There are the obvious play-by-play guys. For the sake of argument here, we worded it such that, like, hey, give us your top three favorite college football TV guys. Mm-hmm. I'm talking more current.
Yep.
We're talking current. So we got a lot of Keith Jackson, which is an acceptable answer, and Vern Lundquist. Right. Very acceptable answers. Yep. Also not still announcing college football, so I got those off of our list here. But these are current guys. We got play-by-play. We also got the color analyst. We also got studio. We got sideline. There are a couple different ways that you can answer this question. So here is some of what we got. Tyler says Gus Johnson, Sean McDonough and Brad Nessler, Carson Cunningham. Hello, Carson, says Joel Klatt, Herbie, Todd Blackledge. He also throws Nessler, Fowler, and McDonough in the play-by-play category.
Yep.
Royce, who's been with us forever, big-time Auburn fan. Hello, Royce. Hope you're doing well. Says Brad Nessler, Chris Fowler, Mark Jones, a good name to throw in here.
Yep.
Rev DJ ESQ says Joel Klatt, Kirk Herbstreit, Brad Nessler. Andy Roberts throws another of the kind of split finger play-by-play color analyst thing with Sean McDonough, Brad Nessler, Joe Tessitore, another good name, along with Joel Klatt, Kirk Herbstreit, Todd Blackledge. Joe Wright, here's a few new names.
I'm ready.
Tom Hart, who I believe is SEC Network.
Yeah.
And Wes Durham, who I think we've talked to Wes before, have we not?
ACC Network.
ACC Network, yep. Bob Wischusen from Daniel. So some good names here.
Yeah.
We didn't ask this question to be critical. Being an announcer is a very difficult job.
No.
So this is more just playing the hits, guys or gals who speak to us in the announcing field.
Right. It's rising to the level of the atmosphere and the moment. There's a lot of different things. It's being a good, quick descriptor. It's sometimes not talking. It's people understanding when to pull away from the mic and not just feel that you are hosting the football show, but rather following along with the game and the game is the star. I think those are all good names. I think Sean McDonough, you can tell a lot of the times when guys have radio experience.
Yeah.
Because they're painting a picture because obviously they have the physical view, but they're also in a stadium. They're also trying to take in the totality of the scene. So they're trying to paint a picture. And so those guys tend to be a little bit better, guys or gals. I am in favor of I think Brad Nessler does a great job. Like there is, I think he is like one of the last of a generation who brings a little bit of, and I don't think it's inauthentic, like folksiness.
There's a little bit of Musburger there, right? A little bit of Musburger.
Musburger, Keith Jackson. Like there's all, you know, he crosses over into baseball and basketball. Like, you know, there's just like, I'm here for you and I'm going to tell you what's going on. There is that to a lot of the older generation of play-by-play guys. Like I think Fowler and Herbstreit are very, very good. They do a good job rising to the moment, and there's some difficulties in the job, of course, in trying to stall or buy time when it's 41-13 at the start of the third, something like that. But all in all, I think who we have in the booth now, like just everybody's going to find somebody annoying and somebody's just not going to land. And that's fine. Like there are times where I think Gus Johnson does a great job. And there are times where I think Gus Johnson is trying to be Gus Johnson in the booth, inauthentically. And so I think he does a very good job, but there are those times where I remember like Gus Johnson and Joel Klatt complaining about statistics or something, or what do they call it? They call everything analytics, even though it's not a catch-all term.
Right.
Where, partner, I'm old school. I don't know about these analytics. I'm like, it's not why you're here. It's not why you're here, Gus and Joel. Sorry. So I'm good with basically everybody who is named here. And I really do like, I think it's Tom Hart does it with Jordan Rogers and Cole Kublik. I think that's on the SEC Network.
Yeah.
There is a certain amount in that crew, and it's not limited to that crew, of course, of We are pumped for this game. We are pumped to be here. We are pumped to share the excitement of this game. And we're pumped to see what's going on and to ride this wave with everybody watching. That you don't get week in and week out that kind of enthusiasm. There is enthusiasm for the product, which I think goes a long way with that specific crew. So I'm for it. It's tough with some of the conference networks where you're juggling, like, especially in the studio, like, there's part of you that is working in PR, right? That you're sure. Just like, eh, you're coming across kind of in a cheeseball way. And I understand the, like, look, there are only so many jobs. You got a good gig, take it. But for those games on the conference networks, be it ACC Network, SEC Network, Big Ten, Pac-12, whatever, like, all in all, I think the product has been pretty good. Harder to see in the Pac-12, but there's an amount of enthusiasm there. Like, even the Pac-12 Network, which doesn't get a bunch of great games, they're getting, you know, down Colorado against down Arizona or something like that. Like you're still getting Ted Robinson, who's a legendary announcer. We love Yogi Roth and how much he loves West Coast football. Like, I'm great with it. I like to hear people happy to be where they are.
The reason that I like this question is because it very much is a question of style.
Yeah.
It's like comedy podcasts, right? Everybody's yeah. got their own genre, their own corner, their own thing that speaks to them. And college football announcing, really anybody on TV, any kind of TV presenter falls into that category. And so what I enjoy just in looking over the list that we got sent to us, even as I try to put my own list together, is which of the styles are personally interesting to me because they enhance my experience of watching the game, and which of the styles are interesting with their announcing partner. So, like, somebody mentioned Bob Wischusen.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Wischusen may not be the first name that comes to mind, but Bob Wischusen called games last year with Dan Orlovsky. Dan Orlovsky is brilliant when it comes to the X's and O's of football.
Polarizing.
He's incredible. He is polarizing to some extent because it is a little bit like drinking out of a fire hose. And I mean that, Dan, in the best, most respectful way possible.
Yeah.
Okay. It does not necessarily connect with someone like me. Bob Wischusen's job as an announcer is to try and bring that back to someone like me and my level. And that can be very difficult to do on the fly when you've got a lot going on in front of you, right? That is a different style that he has to adapt to that may not be readily apparent to those of you at home. Mark Jones is a great answer. Mark Jones worked games last year with Robert Griffin III. Robert Griffin III brings his own flair to the announcing booth. Sometimes a bit irreverent, sometimes a little bit disorganized. We love him. We think he's great. I'd love to hear
especially
more.
Especially given the inexperience, yeah.
We'd love to hear more of RG3. I think he's got a bright future in the announcing world. But for a veteran like Mark Jones, that's got its own unique set of challenges, right? To try and corral that enthusiasm and find a way to not distract from what's going on the TV screen. So each of these guys with their pairings have interesting circumstances that they need to overcome and try to present to the home viewer. So I could list everybody here on this list in front of me. I've got a Wikipedia page up. I could list everybody. I always throw Tom Luginbill out. I love Tom Luginbill. I think Tom Luginbill does a fantastic job as a sideline game analyst. It is a very difficult job.
And so inevitably, any of the analysts in the booth specifically are going to piss off somebody at home watching because they're going to say something bad about their team, right? I don't like Herb Street. I don't like Joel Klatt. I don't like RG3. I don't like Dan Orlovsky because they said that this linebacker's hit was definitely targeting, right? They're like, screw that guy. He doesn't know anything about my team. He doesn't know the rules. He has it out for us because he just thinks it's fun to pick on us, blah, 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 blah. So that's going to be everybody. But what I do appreciate, especially from analysts, because I think it's more their job, is leaning into who they are. And they're not all the same. They're not all asked to do the same thing. And that's what you talked about with Dan Orlovsky versus RG3. Like, I think RG3 comes at it much more from an emotional and recently experienced perspective, whereas Dan Orlovsky is coming at it from, like, the reason why they screwed up that third down play is the quarterback was late trying to hit this window in the zone. He needs to throw it here with this timing and with this footwork. The receiver did the right thing. So even though it looks like the receiver was late or something like that, in fact, it was the quarterback who was late and he's drawing it on the board. Now, some people don't want that technical experience when they're in the midst of watching a college football game. It's much better served after the game or before the game or whatever. But he adds interesting context to me.
Totally.
And so what I want more of from RG3 is more of what Dan Orlovsky is doing. And what I want more of from Dan Orlovsky is what RG3 is doing, right? I want Dan Orlovsky's id. I want him to be excited more just for the sake of being excited, just because a safety made an unbelievable play.
Yeah.
And not describe the assignment. Just be like, this guy's just a monster.
It's a little bit, at times it comes across as a little bit too mathematical, right?
Right. But what I'm saying is, the guys who do who don't go into a specific direction in the booth, or gals, on the sideline, in the booth, whatever, the people who don't do that are the people happily just making everybody think they are fine, right? That, like, they take no chances, they just say, well, we'll see what happens next series, and they're just plain Jane B-minuses. That's why I don't think you are this, but I would love for you to get wild on this show more often, Ty. You're trying to rein me in all the time, but I want to be able to rein you in. I want to be the one saying, easy, Ty, easy. But now that you left the day job,
Get me talking about Notre Dame announcers, then maybe we'll get there.
Right? Who has been the best, the single? I mean, you have Tirico. Tirico's great, right?
Tirico's been incredible. Yeah.
Yeah, he's lights out.
Tirico's been incredible. Dan Hicks was very good. You know where I stand on Tom Hammond, though.
He seemed into being there and the stage of the game, right? Or was he a little bit too...
None of the announcers that NBC has put on the Notre Dame assignment have been not into it.
Right, of course.
All right.
Who is he paired with? Pat Hayden?
He was with Pat Hayden for a while, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So who knows what it looks like this coming year? I'm sure I'll have more opinions as we...
Of course.
As we get a better sense for what that broadcast looks like. But won't be Drew Brees. We know that. Let's move on. Let's go to...
Let's go.
Play the sound again. I believe the results are in for this one.
Do you want to do the least fun teams to root for?
I do.
Because I think I have a really strong wild card answer that nobody gave us. Continue.
The question was the three least fun teams to root for. And as you might expect, this got the most response. All of these questions got a ton of response, but this one got the most.
Yeah.
And so I thought the questions, actually, what I tried to do was pull out the ones that weren't answering from a place of snark, which, by the way, as I said earlier, is alive and well within the Verballer.
Of course, always.
I was trying to pull from the people who I believe answered this question seriously. So our friend Alan Kenny, blatant homerism.
Yeah.
Says, quote, I honestly can't imagine how not fun it must have been rooting for Texas for the last decade plus.
Yeah.
Now, Alan's an Oklahoma guy, but the point is well taken on the Texas side. John Infante also throws out Texas. He mentions Tennessee, which I think is another great answer here.
I was going to say the most honest answers might be about your team's rival, where you're saying, like, look, I know I don't want Texas to win, but man, does that experience, like, on a human level. Like, I feel the same way about Washington. Like, it can't be fun to be a Washington fan, not because of my enjoying beating my brother as a rival, whatever, but more because Washington got a taste and then they couldn't get out of, they lose Chris Peterson. They couldn't get out of the way. They make a bad hire who makes bad coordinator hires. And there's like, they got a taste in the 90s. They got a taste at the turn of the century. They've been down to their rival for a good amount of time. And the same applies for Texas and Oklahoma or whoever, where you're just like, you get a taste and then you can't get out of your own way trying to get it back.
Chaka mentions Kansas, which is a different approach to this question as well.
See, I don't
as
think that's right, but continue.
Nebraska and Maryland. Yeah. I mean, it's been rough for each of those schools in their own regard, but it is definitely a different approach to the question, approach to the answer than someone,
right,
you know, who might say Texas. Mark says, I don't understand how anyone could root for Iowa. It is such an unpleasant brand of football.
Okay. It would be very difficult. Iowa wins games, though.
They do.
They win games. It's not probably the most fun experience. For the first time in a long time, I had that experience as an Oregon fan this year, where Oregon won 10 games, and it was just not that fun to watch. But at least it's not new for Iowa. Iowa, along the way, during the tenure of Kirk Ferentz, they've been to like the New Year's Six BCS-level games. They upset Ohio State. They've beaten Michigan. Like, They win games, albeit in ugly fashion, against good teams playing the brand of football they play. It's sort of like it works for them. And so there is like a Pavlovian acceptance of what Iowa football is by now. They never got the taste of that electric offense. And so I just think they've been beaten down emotionally into this point where they say, and I don't think they're happy with the offense. I don't think the Iowa fan experience watching the Iowa offense is fun. I'm just saying, compared to where some other schools are, who would happily take 8.5 to 10 wins a year, Iowa fans are probably in a better place.
That brings me to this answer, which I think is fascinating, from Towns Finsta. I don't know how I'm supposed to say that.
Please.
The answer is, quote, hot take Alabama. Winning is fun, but it's more fun when you remember what it's like to not be great. I think this is a fascinating answer.
I have in my life rooted for teams that were once again dynastic. I root for the LA Dodgers, who spend a boatload of money and now have won a World Series, a bubble World Series, but a World Series nonetheless. I've been a Laker fan my entire life. I've watched the Lakers win five NBA titles. I got to tell you, it's really fun, but it's not nearly as fun as the journey.
Yeah.
It's not nearly as fun as the Miley Cyrus climb.
It's all about the climb.
And that's right. Not existing for Alabama fans right now. Now, is it better to be an Alabama fan winning, different guys, different coordinators, different defenses, different everything, but the winning stays the same? Or is it more fun if you're an LSU fan to jump up with an all-time offense, be it short burst of 1 year? I say it's more fun to be an LSU fan.
Right.
Because there is LSU fandom keeps you on your toes. Whereas Alabama, you're squarely on your feet. No, there's nothing novel about being an Alabama fan at this point, unless there's some sort of crazy new kind of talent. If they are fielding a 320-pound quarterback, right? That like there's nothing new about being an Alabama fan ever. And so I'm sure the winning is spectacularly fun and doesn't get old. But Alabama fans don't get to experience different kinds of highs that other fans do. And I don't cry for them, but it's not as fun.
I think the proper answer here is a program that is stuck in neutral, perpetually.
Yeah.
Stuck in neutral, perpetually expected to get to 9 wins, but only gets to 7.
Yeah.
Who is your answer for this question?
My answer for this question, in terms of it has to be just a pretty awful experience, given the taste factor, given the recent player factor, given the high level coach factor and inability to stop treading water in lake mediocrity. I have Louisville here.
Ooh.
I have Louisville here. So Louisville in the past like 6 or 7 years has had 10 players drafted, which is not that many. In 2015, they had 10 players drafted.
Yeah.
So that's sort of like the guys recruited in the middle to the tail end of the Charlie Strong era. By the way, I had totally forgotten that Louisville was in the American for a season between the Big East and the ACC. That Louisville had arguably the most electric talent of, I don't know, past 10 years or so.
Generational
one of the best
player.
Three. Yes.
Generational
Lamar Jackson.
Player. Yeah.
They have all these players drafted on both sides of the ball, you know, offensive linemen, safe, like just, it's not just a like Bobby Petrino offense thing. So Bobby Petrino, as Florida State is moving downward, didn't Louisville just completely obliterate Florida State like 52-10 or something 1 year?
Yeah.
I believe they did.
Yeah.
Lamar Jackson. Coming out of Charlie Strong, who wins a Sugar Bowl against Florida, his former team, goes 12-1 the following season. Like, this is a team, they're recruiting Florida. They're finding, they're unearthing gems in Florida, not terribly far away. They're doing a good job on the recruiting trail. They're finding quarterbacks. They're developing offensive skill talent. Bobby Petrino, in slow motion almost, decides to stop recruiting and decides to stop caring. And when the head coach decides to stop caring and treats everybody poorly, you just try to lose all the time. And so they hit rock bottom, not out of nowhere, because people did see it coming and were sounding the alarm. that things were taking a downturn despite the Lamar Jackson era. And then you hire Scott Satterfield, and it's just, what are you going to get week in and week out?
Right.
You got Malik / Mikael Cunningham coming in and looking like the next big thing, but then the turnovers, like, it has to be, and this is the treadmill of mediocrity, the treading water in the lake of mediocrity, the Louisville experience of getting a taste for a quarter. Oh, this is what our offense can be. Oh, we have one of the best five running backs in college football. Oh, he decides to stop playing before the season ends. I think that was a COVID year. That's fine. But there's always something with Louisville to bring Cardinals fans back down to earth. Oh, we've got this mega donor. Oh, Papa John completely implodes physically and personally. Probably not physically, but maybe. There's always something that gives Louisville fans hope for a very short window, and then something quickly thereafter to say, no, sorry, your defensive coordinator is being fired for stalking. Like, there is always something about Louisville that is just always on the precipice of implosion. And they're recruiting really well right now, and so hopefully that's a thing that turns them around. It just has to be so little fun to attach yourself emotionally to this program at this point.
I was thinking Arizona State for many of the same reasons.
Yeah, but they didn't have a taste in the same way that Louisville did, I don't think.
Well, you can go back to the Frank Cush era if you want to.
Yeah, sure. I don't.
But there were tastes here and there. If you go back 25 years, there was that Rose Bowl game, the Jake Plummer game.
Sure.
Which I think was, for many in our generation, the introduction to Arizona State football. But yeah, it's not like they haven't had bigger name coaches come through Tempe. And if you look through the long list of Arizona State football seasons, it's a lot of 7-5 or 6-6 or 5-7. It's a lot of that neutral state that I think drives me the most crazy. And especially now, you want to talk about being on the verge of implosion. We're kind of most of the way there with the Herm Edwards experience, which is probably going to come to an end, I would assume, after the season, if not during the season.
Right.
But it has really been a case, time and again, of there being these expectations and never really being able to live up to them, which as a fan is horribly maddening.
So the only exception I take with ASU is, from afar, I'm not an ASU fan, I don't have too many in my life, it seems that the ASU fan experience is, put out a good team, recruit Southern California, get the guys that, you know, whatever, Oregon, USC, UCLA, and now it's like a national thing. But they weren't going to huge bowl games. They weren't winning 10, 11 games every year with whoever, Todd Graham or Dirk Cutter. They had these big quarterbacks, literally big quarterbacks, and Rudy Carpenter, Sam Keller, and Brock Osweiler, guys like that. But they were almost locked into their identity of being good, not great, putting the fear into the greats and being entertaining, but losing 3, 4, 5 games a year. And so because they never had, you know, they never strung together 3 years of really high level football or 2 years. Like, I think Arizona State fans sort of accept what the program is more than, like, I would have a harder time as a Tennessee fan accepting, you know, the modern era of Tennessee football or West Virginia football. Like, I think West Virginia is an awful experience right now because they got that taste. They got the taste of electric offenses and competing in big bowl games and competing against big teams in a legit way that ASU fans are, they know what their program is.
There's a lot of overlap between ASU and Louisville.
Total, but there's a lot of Louisville has had more of a taste.
Let's not act like Louisville's been a great program. Louisville has not. They've been better.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of overlap there. There's definitely a lot of overlap there.
I'm just saying the Charlie Strong into the early Bobby Petrino part two era of Louisville football should have given Cardinal fans more reason to be optimistic than, I mean, what was the guy's name who's supposed to be the next thing after Lamar Jackson? Big Puma?
Yeah.
Wasn't
Puma Pass.
Yeah. Puma Pass. Juwan Pass. Like, couldn't keep it going. Just couldn't keep it going. Whereas ASU is going 52 on the freeway and Louisville's going 80.
ASU had Todd Graham and the ShamWow little
sure.
speaker
Mike
thing.
Bercovici, Taylor Kelly. Yeah, they had guys. But they had 8-win quarterbacks. Lamar Jackson is a special taste that basically nobody ever gets.
All right. So we're running short on time.
All right. Which one do you want to go to next?
We've got
coaches?
A couple more that we want to do. Yeah, I want to do real quick three coaches who'd be the most dangerous with a major talent upgrade. Got some really interesting answers here. Jeremy, our good friend from out in Salt Lake, says if you give Kyle Whittingham some elite receivers,
definitely.
The Norwegian Gopher is the first to throw out Lance Leipold, who was a frequent name here, listed not only by him, but by Andy, but by Kyle. We had some other folks that threw out Lance Leipold. Colin says Brian Kelly, which is an interesting answer. He may have that opportunity now, Colin,
probably
at LSU.
Yeah.
Adam mentioned Sam Pittman, and he says Sam Pittman is doing a lot with less. Do we agree with that?
Yeah, I think Sam Pittman's a good answer because I think he, given his experience, I think both at Arkansas and Georgia, I think his ability with major, major program type talent would feel about right for his experience. Where, like, you could say Lance Leipold, but you know, you're managing an NFL caliber roster with Lance Leipold, it's a different experience. Now, if you're just talking purely what he's been able to get out of less, what could he get out of more? Sure. But I think Sam Pittman's actually a better answer for that.
Here's another one that I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
PJ Fleck. Do you like PJ Fleck as an answer here?
I guess. I mean, he's, you know, the motivator, the rah-rah guy, but he recruits pretty well at Minnesota compared to what guys did before him for the Gophers.
Like, I have a hard time with that. I understand the perspective. I have a hard time with that answer for the same reason. Another one here listed by the Norwegian Gopher, Pat Fitzgerald.
No.
There was a moment in time where Pat Fitzgerald was the answer to this question. Now I'm not so sure.
Maybe.
I feel like his stock is so far down with what we've seen recently from Northwestern, especially after losing his defensive coordinator last year.
Yeah.
And how that defense took such a precipitous step backwards. I really have a hard time putting him in this category now.
Yeah, I just don't understand. If Pat Fitzgerald had incredible offensive players, he still has not hired good offensive coordinators. He still has leaned into ball control. He still is stubborn, it seems, on offense in terms of what he's having his team let loose and what he's having them do just in terms of serving the defense. Now, what does a Northwestern defense look like with incredible talent? Yes, obviously the sky is the limit if Mike Hankwitz is back there, right? The problem is Pat Fitzgerald and coordinator hiring and what seems to be the philosophy of Pat Fitzgerald teams. They'd be better with a major talent upgrade, but
yeah,
I think Pat Fitzgerald's still in the way a bit. Like, I think Jonathan Smith is a great answer here.
Yep, yep.
With what he was able to do with Chris Peterson at Washington, what he's been able to do running the ball especially, developing nowhere near NFL caliber quarterbacks into Pac-12 winning quarterbacks, like win a bunch of Pac-12 games. I think Mike Gundy's a good answer here.
Yeah, somebody by the name of TB, their handle is TB Go Pokes, who'd have guessed it?
Yeah.
Mike Gundy was his answer, along with Sean Lewis, who's from Kent State.
Right.
And your boy, Jeff Hafley. You like the Gundy answer?
The Gundy answer is good because they've, since I guess Mason Rudolph, Taylor Cornelius, I don't know. It's taken a downturn at quarterback. They developed so many good receivers for so long. They've had offensive line questions, but they seem to have decent offensive skill talent. They've seemed to have, like, they put it all together last year with the defense. But if you were to give him a deeper roster, if you were able to attract a deeper, more talented roster with how well Mike Gundy has hired coordinators and assistants, by and large, there have been exceptions, that they seem like they threaten to win double digits without high, high level top 15 classes, it does become interesting what they could do with.
Let's move on.
Yeah.
Very
quickly. Were there any other answers? I had, like, see, the thing is, I think Bud Elliott wrote a piece about this. The Big 12 outside of Oklahoma and Texas recruits like a G5 conference. So you could say Chris Klieman, you could say Dave Aranda, you could say any of these guys, and the answer is probably yeah, because yeah. They can't recruit like decent Power 5 teams.
Yeah, dangerous with a major talent upgrade, again, yeah. was the question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's Pat Fitzgerald, to me, highlights everything that's both good and bad about this question, because
right.
You know, I think conventional wisdom is that this is a good coach. He's been there for a good long time. He's had a lot of success at a place where it's difficult to do so. You give him more talent, clearly he will know what to do with it. I don't know if we can assume as much.
Right.
And that might be the way I approach it with a number of these guys. Like even Lance Leipold, you can throw mm-hmm. him in there. Lance Leipold's been very successful. If you give him a lot of talent at the major college level, what happens? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. We just haven't seen it. But
so who do you want to conclude with the best coaches in the sport that are not named Nick Saban?
I wanted to conclude with best college football food towns, but we can also
okay.
go with non-Saban coaches. Let's start there and we'll conclude
okay.
with the food towns. Top three coaches not named Nick Saban. As you might expect, we got a variety of big name coaches here, including two folks who throughout Mel Tucker, one of whom is Mel Tucker Domination on Twitter.
I saw that.
And another named Standing Room Spartans. Thank you.
I got to say,
participation.
I don't know if it's our show specifically that attracts these types. Probably not. I can appreciate with how low Michigan State got at the end of the Mark D'Antonio era with the excitement around Mel Tucker at Michigan State. But is there another fan base that loves their coach as much? Not that has a better coach or a worse coach, but like the Mel Tucker adoration in East Lansing beyond.
It's 100% Clemson. 100% Clemson and Dabo.
Yeah, no, obviously there is that factor with Dabo. But Dabo's been around since whatever, 2008. Like they've had time to grow to love and appreciate and worship him.
Right.
Misguided. Perhaps.
You're talking Tinder, swipe right, I'm all in.
I'm talking there is a level of heart palpitation
okay.
among the Michigan State faithful. And I love it. I love it. But I'm a little bit worried about love turning into lust. That it's getting out of hand.
Yeah.
College football coach. I love the commitment. I love the like, oh my God, we have an offense for the first time in quite some time. But I am not surprised, but taken aback that it was the Michigan State fan base that fell in love so quickly. The like Pete Davidson, Ariana Grande experience is alive yeah. and well. Big
I'm
Mel
with you.
Energy. Yeah.
So some of the others that were thrown out here, and you know what names
yeah, sorry,
to expect.
Continue.
No, it's good.
Yeah.
Steven, who, by the way, gave my uncle card trick advice way back when,
right.
says Jimbo, Dabo, and Kirby. Kirby Smart. Matt says Ryan Day. Pat Narduzzi. Okay, we can talk about Pat Narduzzi. And Lincoln Riley, another one that I would expect to see here. Check
totally.
Down screen says Kirby Smart, Dave Aranda, Dabo Sweeney. Deconstructing engineer says Aranda, Lane Kiffin. I don't know about that one, but okay. Kyle Whittingham, a great answer. And then Adam says it's Dabo, Kirby, and then 50 feet of crap. So
yeah,
thank you to everyone. There are many other answers, but who's your answer here? Who's the best? Who are the top three non-Saban coaches?
So
right now?
The case for Dabo, the case for Kirby, the case for a lot of guys is obvious because you're either saying they have a lot of talent and maximized it by going to the playoff or winning national championships. Or they don't have a lot of talent, but they are able to get the most out of that talent and perhaps outperform, you know, a lack of NFL draft picks or whatever. However you're going to measure, whether it's recruiting rankings, whether it's draft picks, whatever. I have, if you're taking all of those into consideration, I am a little bit down just the context of Ryan Day as being top level because he's had playoff caliber and national championship caliber talent his entirety there and hasn't consistently been winning in the playoff.
We got a question 2 weeks ago about
yeah.
On one of our Bruinays, which you can tune into via Patreon every Friday.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We got a question asking whether or not Ryan Day is a secret bust.
Right.
And it was a good question. I don't know if I believe it, but the phrasing of the question was actually quite interesting. And you could make that case if you really wanted to about Ryan Day. So I agree. I don't think he's a good answer here.
Kyle Whittingham's a really good answer. I know we got a little bit of pushback on Kyle Whittingham, but I don't know. They took a team from a G5 level. He took a team from a G5 level conference. He's been there for a long time. He has evolved. He has raised the talent level. He has won the conference. He took Ohio State to the brink in the Rose Bowl. Like, I think Kyle Whittingham is a terrific answer here because he is a less dramatic version of Kirk Ferentz, who I also think is actually a pretty strong answer for this question. You win games without offense. You're a good coach. You're a bad coach because you're stiff and you're unable to adapt. But if it's wins and losses, if it's a make-miss league, like they say in the NBA, Kirk Ferentz and Iowa are making a bunch. Kyle Whittingham has fielded better offenses, has fielded better quarterbacks, has hired better coordinators. But man, they are just, they play to an identity. They recruit well. They develop guys for the NFL. He has to be considered among the top handful of coaches in the sport.
Well, that's why he was one of the names that I think came up for the USC job.
Sure.
Right. Kyle Whittingham has been doing it at a pretty high level for a long time, a less dramatic version of some others.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's a great answer here. I think Dave Aranda is an interesting answer. I'd like to see more from Dave Aranda. Dave
Aranda's, more resume.
Yeah, Dave Aranda's resume as a head coach is still pretty short, but I think given his, he doesn't have that stubbornness quality to his coaching style, right? We've talked ad nauseum about how he's quick to adapt and not afraid to adapt and admit when he was wrong, and it paid huge dividends last year as Baylor won the Big 12. Dave Aranda could be a very good answer here, but it's probably a little too early. Pat Narduzzi from Matt.
Okay.
I don't know if I follow here, Dan. Do you?
So Pat Narduzzi has kept Pitt winning, sometimes on an interestingly good level, sometimes on a forgettably good level, has fielded some good offenses, some good defenses, has been steady, but one of the best coaches in the country. I think there has to be more of a clear strength and identity and consistency to a program than what Pitt has been.
Right.
That's my issue there. I don't think James Franklin's in this conversation right now. There are guys on this list. There are guys on people's lists, or there are guys just on the list of, Power Five or FBS head coaches where they had a crazy amount of success that, of course, they should be considered among the best coaches in the sport in a vacuum. But perhaps the place they're currently at, they're not shining. And maybe it's an example of having better talent. Like, if Chip Kelly were coaching at a place with better talent, and I know the talent is on him at UCLA and why they don't have a better roster ultimately, but would it, with generic team A and versus generic team B, you could do a lot worse than having Chip Kelly coach that roster. At his best, Chip Kelly's one of the best coaches in the sport. Mack Brown, at his best, has done a great job of finding talent and winning games. Now, there are stretches for both of those guys where you're like, maybe they lost it. Maybe it's not there anymore. But they also should be considered among, the guys with the best aptitude for the job.
Yeah. It's way too early, of course, to give this answer, but I think
Dan Lanning.
No.
Marcus Freeman.
Any of the new guys at big places.
Yeah.
Could be interesting answers 5 years from now. I'm particularly keen on Billy Napier.
Okay.
I really like that hire.
Sure.
The one thing we saw time and again about Louisiana is they played hard. And that was at a place where he did not have the level of talent that he has now inherited and will hopefully recruit to come to Gainesville. Mm-hmm. He's a smart coach and his teams are in games. I think those are the guys that I'm always fascinated to see how they scale up when they go to a bigger place. He could be a name that I think is interesting here, but we need to see more data. There aren't a whole lot of names that you could really throw out here. A name
I would have had on here before the past 2 years would have been Paul Christ.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where there's a dependability of good to greatness, a clear strength, a clear identity on offense, strength being defense, that how do you not consider Paul Christ and the run he's had for the decade-ish that he's been at Wisconsin, among the sport's best. But the downturn on offense these past couple of years has me questioning his place in that top group. So I think there are a lot of cases to be made, but like Brian Kelly is among the best coaches in the sport, 100%. Absolutely is.
All right. Well, look.
I don't know if there's anybody, like, but I don't include Jimbo in that right now. Too much mediocrity. Too soon.
Interesting. All right. So look, we're going to save top college food towns.
Okay.
For the episode that we do next week or maybe on the Friday Patreon show. I don't know. We'll figure it out. But we're running so far over time here. We cannot thank everyone enough for their feedback. It's been a lot of fun going through all of this. Stay tuned to all of our social media accounts. We're going to continue to do more stuff like this, not just through the off season, but particularly as we get closer to the season. Everybody's going to have opinions forming, bubbling within as they try to figure out what the 2022 season is going to look like. So we're going to do our best to try and tap into what we know is the a very opinionated and very snarky and fun fan base here among our Verballerhood. Don't forget to follow us on social media if you want more. Don't forget to follow and subscribe to the podcast if you'd like to hear more as well. Again, a big hearty thank you to everybody who sent in their feedback. Here's the way this thing works now.
Okay.
If you go on out to verballers.com, that is our Patreon.
Spell it.
VERBALLERS.com.
Great.
That will take you over to our Patreon. You can get access to the shows that we do every Friday called the Brew and A. It is a Q&A show that we do, usually around midday. Everybody gets access to it live.
Mm-hmm.
You ask us questions via Discord, via Patreon, via email, and we do our best to answer them. That is a Verballer exclusive. Again, verballers.com is where you can go to get more information on that. SolidGiveaway.com. As I said at the top, we've got a giveaway going on right now. Brian Brzee signed mini helmet. Speaking of Clemson, a few quick and easy and free steps. That's all you need to do in order to get your name in the hat. And last but certainly not least, tell your friends if you like this show. Daniel, that's all we got for today.
Yes, that's it.
For that guy over there, my good friend Dan Rubenstein, for myself, Ty Hildenbrand, thanks so much for downloading, for listening, for supporting the show, wherever you may be. We will talk to you all next week. In the meantime, stay solid.
Peace.